From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the latest on the Ukraine crisis. UN scaling up aid for the CAR during the rainy season. U.S. top diplomat to promote trade and security on his Africa trip. Also ahead, two former popes proclaim saints. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. A group of European monitors detained by pro-Russian insurgents in eastern Ukraine appeared in public on Sunday to give assurances they are not being mistreated, even as negotiations began to secure their release. With armed rebels watching as they spoke, the leader of the monitors for the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, German Colonel Axel Schneider, assured reporters in Slovyansk that they were in good health. The insurgents called the eight military observers prisoners of war. Schneider said they're being held for political reasons.
Our presence here in Slovyansk is for sure a political instrument for the decision makers here in the region. And the possibility to use it for negotiations.
Meanwhile, at a news conference in Malaysia, President Obama warned economic sanctions against Russia will be stiffened because he said Moscow is encouraging unrest in the largely Russian-speaking eastern Ukraine.
There's strong evidence that they've been encouraging the kinds of activities that have been taking place in eastern and southern Ukraine. And so collectively, us and the Europeans have said that so long as Russia continues down the path of provocation rather than trying to resolve this issue peacefully and de-escalating, there are going to be consequences, and those consequences will continue to grow.
In Washington, a national security official said new sanctions this week will target Russia's defense industry and companies with close links to Russian President Vladimir Putin. In a joint statement late on Friday, the group of seven major economies announced it had agreed to move swiftly on new sanctions against Russia because of its interference in Ukraine. President Obama says the United States and Europe must act together in levying sanctions against Russia over its actions in Ukraine that he says threatens the country's independence and sovereignty. Russia's intervention in Ukraine surprised many experts, but some say it should have been expected, based partly on something that happened last September in Armenia that received much less attention. VOA's Al Pessin is in London with our report.
It was all smiles for the cameras when Armenian President Serge Sargsyan met with Russian President Vladimir Putin in September and expressed his intention to join the Russian-led customs union. The Armenian leader abandoned more than 2 years of negotiations on an association agreement with the European Union. Russian pressure worked in that situation, but it backfired 2 months later when Ukrainian President Viktor Yanukovych did the same thing, sparking months of protests, a violent crackdown, and his ouster by the parliament, where members of his own party voted against him. That left President Putin with a choice: accept the changes in Ukraine and potentially lose his special relationship with more former Soviet states, or take action and sacrifice his relationship with the West. The director of the Regional Studies Center in Armenia, Richard Jiragosyan, spoke via Skype.
Russian policy has significantly shifted, where limits and restraint no longer apply. And more importantly, Russia is now firm and committed to pushing back and pushing out EU engagement in the so-called near abroad.
The shift surprised European leaders, but it shouldn't have, particularly regarding Ukraine, according to Nina Schick of London's Open Europe Research Center.
Some would say that it was a mistake that they made, that they didn't take the Russian position more into account. The reality is that the Russian sphere of influence in Ukraine is far greater than perhaps they'd like to admit.
But Richard Yerogoyan disagrees, saying it was reasonable 25 years after the fall of the Soviet Union to expect Russia to accept a turn to the West by its former satellites. He says Russia's current policy runs counter to its own interests.
And it's a short-sighted and short-term pursuit of raw power. And in effect, they're recreating a new Iron Curtain through the former Soviet space.
Everyone!
Or trying to. Yerogoyan says former Soviet states will resist such moves and the West will impose significant economic costs if Russia continues to use force to try to impose its will on Ukraine or other neighbors. Al Pessin, VOA News, London.
Hardline nationalist turned pro-European reformer Aleksandar Vučić has been elected Serbia's new prime minister. 198 members of parliament voted in favor of Mr. Vučić and his cabinet on Sunday, while 23 voted no, 7 abstain. He told lawmakers they will sleep and eat inside the parliament building until they pass his economic reform package. He said the old way of doing things in Serbia has driven away investors and has failed to create jobs and fight corruption. New economic package includes spending cuts and tax increases. The opposition already is dismissing it as populism and empty promises. Also making news with the Middle East peace talks in crisis, the Palestinian leader has expressed rare sympathy for Jewish suffering. Robert Berger reporting now from the VOA Jerusalem Bureau.
Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas has described the Holocaust as the most heinous crime against humanity in the modern era. Mr. Abbas issued the written statement on the eve of Holocaust Remembrance Day, an annual Israeli observance in memory of the 6 million Jews killed by the Nazis during World War II. It was an unusual comment for an Arab leader and appeared to be an about-face for Mr. Abbas. Israeli officials have accused him of playing down the scope of the Holocaust in a doctoral dissertation in the 1970s. President Abbas, who heads the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank, appears to be reaching out to the Israeli public following the collapse of 9 months of peace talks last week. Israel suspended the negotiations after the Palestinian leader agreed to form a unity government with the Islamic militant group Hamas, which controls the Gaza Strip. Hamas refuses to renounce violence or recognize Israel, and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said he would never negotiate with a terrorist group that denies his country's right to exist. At the weekly cabinet meeting in Jerusalem, Mr. Netanyahu also dismissed the comments of Mr. Abbas on the Holocaust, saying they were designed to placate global public opinion. He accused President Abbas of joining forces with Hamas, describing it as a group that both denies the Holocaust and wants to bring about a second Holocaust by destroying the State of Israel. Palestinian chief negotiator Saab Erekat believes a unity government would actually benefit the peace process, so he says Israel's position does not make sense.
I don't know why, how Israel is thinking anymore.
Erekat told Israel's army radio that President Abbas has been crystal clear. Hamas will have to accept his policies on peace.
He said, I'll form a government with my program, organizing Israel, accepting the two-state solution, accepting agreement signed, and not accepting violence. So what does Israel want?
For Prime Minister Netanyahu, the answer is fairly simple.
Abu Mazen צריך לבחור בין הברית עם החמאס, ארגון טרור שקורא להשמדת ישראל ומכחיש את השואה.
Addressing Mr. Abbas by his nom de guerre, he said, Abu Mazen must choose between his alliance with Hamas and making a true peace with Israel. Robert Berger for VOA News, Jerusalem.
International watchdog charged with getting chemical weapons out of Syria is calling on the government to hand over its remaining materials. Sigrid Kaag, special coordinator of the Joint Mission of the United Nations and the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, told a news conference in Damascus on Sunday that more than 92% of Syria's chemical weapons have been removed from the country or destroyed so far.
I strongly encourage the authorities to complete the job as soon as possible in the proximity of Syria's own internal deadline of 27th of April, so the 30th of June deadline can be met.
Washington and its Western allies have blamed Syrian President Bashar al-Assad's forces for unleashing the deadly nerve agent sarin. The Syrian government blames the rebels for the use of sarin.
From the ordinary to the extraordinary, you never know what in the world will happen next.
The world is watching with grave concern as Russia has positioned its military.
You should not allow anyone to deprive you of your right to determine the future.
We are using this against terrorist groups coming from Turkey.
With a landing on
and
civilians.
Sponsored by, no, we are not killing civilians. This
with all that's happening, VOA News works to keep you up to date every hour of every day. So when you want to know what's new, you know what to do. Tune in your radio or click on the internet. World News on the hour, every hour, or at your convenience at voanews.com.
Reuters is reporting that at least 22 people, including five local chiefs and three members of the staff of the medical charity Doctors Without Borders, also known as MSF, were killed in an attack on the town of Nanga Bogila in the Central African Republic on Saturday. A spokesman for the MSF confirmed the deaths of its staff but gave no further details. Salika rebels are accused of the attack, and the group's officials were not immediately available for comment. The mainly Muslim Salika forces seized Bangui, the capital of CAR, in March of 2013, but their time in power was highlighted by killings and other rights abuses, prompting the creation of the mainly Christian anti-Balaka militia, which the UN believes is carrying out ethnic cleansing against the Muslims. Meantime, heavily armed peacekeepers have escorted some of the last remaining Muslims out of CAR's capital, trucking more than 1,300 people who for months have been trapped by Christian militants. Giuseppe Lobretta is the chief of the International Organization for Migration in the CAR.
For the PKK, the central mosque, the plan is not to leave. We are working on social cohesion. There are other projects to keep them here. Like the Cash for Work project, like other dialogue that will start. I'm not sure that they want to leave. Actually, they told us that they prefer to stay in Bangui. The condition is the security.
Exodus further partitions the country, a process that has been underway since January, when a Muslim rebel government gave up power nearly a year after overthrowing the president of a decade. The United Nations has described the forced displacement of tens of thousands of Muslims, as I mentioned earlier, as ethnic cleansing. U.S. aid agencies are also scaling up humanitarian operations in the CAR as the rainy season takes hold. Lisa Schlein reporting now from the UN in Geneva.
The onset of the rainy season in the Central African Republic is intensifying the vulnerability of some 400,000 internally displaced people who are dependent upon life-saving international aid. As roads become impassable, humanitarian agencies are having greater difficulty reaching many of these desperate people, and the dangers have not gone away. The Organization for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs reports confrontations between armed troops and direct attacks on villages over the past week in the central part of the country have caused more than 5,000 people to flee their homes and seek shelter in religious sites. OCHA spokesman Jens Laerke says access to these areas is limited.
One area where access has actually improved slightly is in Boda, where we've been able to provide additional relief for 24,000 vulnerable people. There's been food distribution, medical, nutrition, non-food items, and wash support has been provided.
Despite the security risks, the World Food Programme says it has managed to distribute food to more than 140,000 people this month. In anticipation of the rainy season, WFP spokeswoman Elizabeth Beers tells VOA the agency began pre-positioning food early this month and, in conjunction with the Food and Agriculture Organization, has started to distribute seeds and tools to help farmers plant their crops.
In parallel, WFP provide food ration to the same people so that they do not have to eat the seeds for the agricultural season. Most roads are impassable and the people, thousands of people, will be in need of assistance. That's why it was very important to start those distribution as early as possible.
She says WFP will continue to scale up its operation. The UN Children's Fund reports the number of children being treated for severe acute malnutrition in Bangui's largest hospital has tripled compared to last year. UNICEF estimates 28,000 children will suffer from this worst form of malnutrition this year. It says it is ramping up its nutritional treatment program to keep these children alive. UN agencies say their efforts to address the country's humanitarian crisis is hampered by a serious lack of money. And they note that only 28% of the international appeal for $551 million in funds has been received. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry will travel to sub-Saharan Africa this week. He'll have stops in Ethiopia, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and Angola. Here's Mr. Kerry's spokesperson, Jennifer Saki.
On the trip, he will encourage democratic development, promote respect for human rights, advance peace and security, engage with civil society and young African leaders who will shape the continent's future, and promote trade, investment, and development partnerships in Africa. The Secretary's trip will also highlight U.S. investments in the PEPFAR program. In Addis Ababa, Secretary Kerry will co-convene the fourth session of the US-AU high-level dialogue and discuss a range of issues on which we partner with the African Union. Secretary Kerry will meet with both the Prime Minister and the Foreign Minister to discuss efforts to advance peace and democracy in the region and strengthen important areas of bilateral cooperation with Ethiopia. In Kinshasa, Secretary Kerry will meet with President Kabila and will discuss how the DRC's government's progress in neutralizing some of the dozens of dangerous armed groups that victimize the Congolese people can be consolidated, and how to best advance the DRC's democratization and long-term stability, including through a timely and transparent electoral process. In Luanda, Secretary Kerry will commend President Dos Santos for Angola's leadership of the International Conference on the Great Lakes region, and encourage the President's continued personal engagement in the Great Lakes peace process. The Secretary will also discuss bilateral policy and trade issues with the Foreign Minister.
Yes, Secretary of State spokesperson Jennifer Saki said Secretary Kerry visited North and West Africa earlier this month. His trip included stops in Algiers, where he met with officials to discuss ways to combat terrorism and strengthen security in the region. On Sunday, South Africans marked two decades of multiracial democracy following the end of apartheid. President Jacob Zuma spoke during a ceremony attended by thousands.
We should congratulate ourselves for all this hard work. We must not deny or downplay these achievements, regardless of our political differences or contestation at any given time, including the election period. Facts should remain facts.
South Africans go to the polls on May 7th, and the polls' surveys are indicating Mr. Zuma's African National Congress will be staying in power. 20 years ago, South Africans of all races voted in the country's first democratic election, bringing the ANC to power and making Nelson Mandela the country's first black president. Sunday's Freedom Day celebration was the first since Mr. Mandela died on December 5th last year. Doctors Without Borders says a new technique of fighting malaria with preventive drug treatments now being rolled out in countries across the Sahel can reduce malaria cases by up to 83% in children under the age of five. Jennifer Lazuda is in Dakar with our report.
International medical organization Doctors Without Borders, known by its French acronym MSF, says that seasonal malaria chemo prevention campaigns, known as SMCs, could help to reduce the number of malaria deaths among children under the age of 5 in the Sahel. The full course of treatment consists of intermittent doses of tablets to children during malaria seasons and thus prevents new cases in countries where the mosquito-borne illness is endemic. The World Health Organization, WHO, says more than 620,000 people worldwide died from malaria last year. The majority of the victims were children in sub-Saharan Africa, where less than 50% of the population has access to insecticide-treated bed nets. Millions more in Africa do not have access to malaria testing or treatments. Elena Koskalova, an epidemiologist and malaria expert for MSF, spoke to VOA from Niger, where MSF carried out a pilot SMC campaign during last year's malaria high season.
Malaria in Niger, as in many African countries, is a main cause of morbidity and mortality in children under 5. So prevention, of course, prevents that the child gets sick. So then logically it decreases the morbidity and mortality due to malaria.
During 4 months last year, Koskalova says more than 200,000 children between the ages of 3 months and 5 years from more than 1,000 villages in Niger received a course of antimalarial tablets during the height of the country's malaria season. MSF says the number of cases of both simple and severe malaria decreased by more than 80% in the areas where children received SMC treatment. The WHO first recommended SMC treatment in 2012, but is only now starting to gain popularity in other African countries, such as Mali and Chad, where similar successes have been seen. Koskalova says the SMC treatment costs an estimated $4 per child per season. Less than 1% of those who receive the treatment experience mild side effects, such as vomiting. Despite the successes of SMC, Koskalova said it is important to remember that this strategy alone does not prevent all cases of malaria.
The SMC preventive treatment, it's not a miracle cure, so it means it's part of a package of malaria preventive and curative strategies. So it means it cannot stand alone. So as I already told you, some children were already sick at the time of SMC distribution. So, of course, for these children, it's essential to have access to diagnostic and treatment.
Niger's Ministry of Health is now including SMC in its 2014 National Malaria Control Program, following last year's success. MSF hopes to treat 400,000 children in Niger this year, starting in July. Jennifer Lazuda for VOA News, Dakar.
To really understand what's happening today, take a look at what happened yesterday.
Flash, Washington. The White House announces Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor.
That's one small step for man.
I have a dream.
The Beatles.
The presidential car coming up now. We know it's the presidential car. You see Mrs. Kennedy's pink suit. There's a Secret Service man, spread eagle, over the top of the car.
The only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
Listen to Today in History, weekdays on the Voice of America, following International Edition.
And we're just a few minutes away from Dave DeForest bringing us Today in History. Pope Francis, leader of the Roman Catholic Church, has proclaimed two of his predecessors, John the 23rd and John Paul II, saints at a ceremony Sunday in St. Peter's Square.
Ioannem vicesimum tertium et Ioannem Paulum secundum, sanctos esse decernimus et definimus, ac sanctorum catalogo adscribimus, statuentes eos in universa ecclesia, inter santos pia devotionis recoli debere, in nomine Patris et Filii et Spiritus Sancti.
And it was with that proclamation that those two men did become saints on Sunday. Officials say as many as 1 million people crowded St. Peter's and the nearby streets of Rome for the elevation to sainthood ceremony. It is the first time two former popes have been elevated to sainthood at the same time. The newly canonized popes are widely seen as representing contrasting factions of the Roman Catholic Church. And with that, we'll say goodbye for today. were some other stories to tell you there, but I ran out of time. So we're going to say goodbye. Thanks for joining us here on The Voice of America. Hope you'll stay tuned. The latest world news is coming up shortly. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Carl Starling, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. We hope you have a great Monday.
This is Today in History. On April 28, 1758, James Monroe, the fifth U.S. president, was born. Monroe is best known for the doctrine that bears his name. It discouraged European interference in the Western Hemisphere, seeking to avoid any attempts to make the New World a battleground for Old World nations. On April 28, 1881, U.S. outlaw and folk hero William H. Bonney, better known as Billy the Kid, escaped from a courthouse jail in New Mexico. The Kid had been awaiting execution, having been found guilty of murder. 3 months later, the icon of the American Wild West was shot and killed by a sheriff. In 1908, ethnic German businessman Oskar Schindler was born in what is now the Czech Republic. Schindler saved the lives of hundreds of his Jewish factory workers during World War II. His efforts are recounted in the book and movie Schindler's List. In 1937, Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein was born. Leading his country into two devastating wars, Saddam's nearly 25-year rule was characterized by brutal suppression of internal dissent. He was overthrown in the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq in 2003. He was captured later that year, tried, and later executed. In 1945, Italian communist partisans executed former dictator Benito Mussolini and his mistress as the fascist leader attempted to flee to Switzerland near the close of World War II. On this day in 1969, Charles de Gaulle resigned as president of France after his proposals for constitutional reform were defeated in a national referendum. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On April 28th, in the United States, in Israel, and in many places around the world, we observe Yom HaShoah, which means Day of Remembrance of the Holocaust. In ceremonies across the globe, observers read from the Book of Names and light six candles in honor of the 6 million Jews who perished. Holocaust survivors engage with their communities and share their personal stories. The Holocaust was the greatest crime in human history. 6 million Jews were murdered by the Nazi regime and its collaborators solely because they were Jewish. It began in the 1930s when the Nazi Party came to power and the German government began to target those they deemed to be inherently inferior. Such people, mostly civilians, were rounded up, shut into ghettos, and deported to dozens of concentration or slave labor camps. Some were shot and dumped into mass graves. By 1941, a number of camps were being run specifically for mass killing. Those sent to slave labor camps were slowly starved or worked to death. In addition to Jews, the Nazis targeted a number of other groups, including Roma, the disabled, homosexuals, and the Slavic peoples, because of their perceived inferiority. Some were persecuted on political or ideological grounds, among them communists, socialists, Jehovah Witnesses, Freemasons, and anyone who resisted the Nazi dictatorship. In the aftermath of the Second World War, the international community resolved never again to allow such atrocities to occur. In 1948, the United Nations General Assembly adopted the Convention on the Prevention and the Punishment of the Crime of Genocide. In 1979, the United States Congress established the Day of Remembrance and later the Holocaust Memorial Museum to keep the memory of the victims alive for future generations. Today, this museum has its own Center for Genocide Prevention. The legacy of Holocaust victims enriches our understanding and is a symbol of the meaning of human dignity. In America, survivors remind us of the importance of tolerance by speaking in classrooms and community institutions across the country. They serve as living history, sharing their stories and recounting the experiences of all who perished. Poet Claire Guest writes, "We couldn't stop the horror. We couldn't stop the hate. We can't change history. We are here too late. But what we can do is remember in our thoughts and in our ways. Let these memories guide our actions."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.